everyone, and the conference organisers. It's been great fun coming. Got here actually a numerical solution of the stochastic partial differential equation for no reason other than to say that it's an example of where you have to do things extremely carefully with numerical simulations. Because stochastic effects can have very subtle impacts on the solution. And in fact, if you push the noise up a little bit higher on this solution, what happens is on this problem is the zero solution restabilizes. So you add noise and you stabilize something that's unstable, which is a bit paradoxical. So I'm going to start off talking about numerics and then make a transition. So there is going to be something stochastic in this talk because I've got about an hour and a half worth of material, and there's one thing for sure, you don't want to listen to me for an hour and a half today. So at some stage I'll make a random transition to section three where I'll start talking about boundary conditions for continuum models after having started on talking about boundary conditions for numerical models. And I'll introduce that by talking about a toy problem where we can do some things exactly. So that's the scheme. So let's have a look at this toy problem that I want to start introducing a couple of ideas on. I should say that the thrust of my research for the last 20 years is to create models which have got high fidelity. So the idea is you're given a mathematical model, such as the Navier-Stokes equation, that you're completely satisfied with. How can you generate simpler models from that? And my aim is to do that really well. It's not all that I do. And for example, the talk tomorrow at lunchtime at 1:10, I've shifted that for some people who've got other appointments, is completely different. And it's related to walls and mean equations and a few other things. Let's get back to here. So let's do some modelling with high fidelity. As an example, just have a look at this particular differential equation. Du by dt is u d squared u dx squared, a nonlinear diffusion equation. It's actually comes to me from a student who's doing a project on the dripping of honey. So in some weird way, this is the Lagrangian description of honey dripping out of a teaspoon. But I won't do that experiment for you because it's extremely messy. I'm also using the wrong boundary conditions, I'm going to solve it here with u equal to zero on x is equal to plus or minus one. So you know what'll happen to anything like that. The solution is going to, you start off in some state, and the solution is going to be something which here, in fact, is exactly a parabola. It's one advantage in using that particular differential equation. And that parabola decays algebraically. And I can show you that in a simple numerical simulation. All right, so here is an initial condition on minus 1, 1, and let's see how it evolves. So the structure that you see there decays very quickly, and all that you're left for a very long time is this algebraically decaying parabola. Now, what I want to do is to show you that I can do something that looks really dodgy, but nonetheless reproduces this exact solution. And then what I'm going to do is do that same dodgy trick in some more complicated problems. So what is the dodginess? We play around with the boundary conditions. It's all about boundary conditions. Now, we solved the previous problem with u is equal to zero on the boundary conditions. So if you look at this equation here, this is the new boundary conditions. If I put gamma is equal to 1, that right-hand side vanishes, and so it's just a condition that u is naught. That's what I started with. However, for non-zero gamma, it turns out you can solve this problem exactly still, and the solution is still a decaying parabola. Right, so it's just 1 minus gamma x squared instead of 1 minus x squared, and it still decays out algebraically. That's one particular solution out of course, all the myriad of ones that could occur, but everything else decays exponentially to this. But what happens now is, with that parameter gamma, a center manifold appears here. Why? Well, when gamma is zero, the boundary conditions that we see, 2 gamma u is equal to plus or minus 1 minus gamma du by dx, turn out to be insulating because the gamma u term disappears. So this is just insulating boundary conditions at the side. There's a conservative mode that everything goes, evolves to u is equal to a constant inside this domain. The constant is arbitrary, it just depends upon your initial conditions. But it's an attractive set of equilibria. You linearize about each one of those equilibria and you find that things decay to it with an eigenvalue 0 corresponding to the fact that it's an equal, there's a family of them, and everything else is decaying exponentially quickly. They're all the higher wave number structures going to 0. This is exactly the classic picture for a center manifold. 0 eigenvalues, the rest negative. So, there exists a center manifold parameterized by the set of equilibria u naught and this parameter gamma. Right, so gamma is equal to 0 is where the statement of existence takes place. You can find it exactly in this problem, and it's nothing other than what I showed you before, that u of xt is 1 minus gamma of x squared times u naught, where u naught evolves in time. So that's over here. U naught, the u by dt is minus 2 gamma u naught squared, and you set that to your undergraduate students and they'll tell you it decays algebraically. All right, now the point about this description is it's a model. It recovers the earlier exact solution when gamma is equal to 1 on a theory based about gamma is 0. And that's what I like, because that's the sort of thing I'm going to do later, is to perturb problems, apply this sort of theory, and recover something for the unperturbed problem. There's something else that gets thrown into the mix here, and that is what I like calling the relevance theorem of center manifold theory. It says that for all solutions of the original problem that you're trying to solve, there exists an initial condition for your model such that there's exponentially decaying difference between the prediction, between the original system and your model. Right, this is a really strong error statement. Right? It just says, sure, there's going to be some initial transients which you don't track, but if you start off your model correctly, you're going to track down to the correct solution exponentially quickly. And you can see this in a picture that will also be relevant later. Here's a completely separate dynamical system in 2 variables. Right? It's not an infinite dimensional example anymore. It's got a center manifold, which is this curve here, and I'm going to start it with a whole heap of initial conditions. So here's 100 simulations all done at once. All right, so there's the exponential attraction to the center manifold, and apart from a few errors, a little bit of exponentially small error towards the end. After that transient, everything evolves as if you're on the center manifold, and you can see that because everything's there. So now what you can do is you join up all the points which have reached the same position, because they're the ones, they're the set of all points which have the same long-term evolution. And what that means, if, for example, your original system starts here, then the initial condition you should give to the model is this one over here. Right, so these are all the points which have the same long-term evolution. So if your system is here, the way to make sure the prediction of your model is correct is to start your model up there. And, actually, John Guggenheimer first invented these manifolds in the context of oscillations, trying to make sure the phase was right in a hot bifurcation. Okay, so moving on to part two, how can you use this trick of fudging boundary conditions in more complicated problems? So we've used it here. Okay, so let's move on to a more numerical type problem. But as the example, I'll use exactly the same nonlinear diffusion equation, although that's doesn't take a big part in the ideas that I'm going to talk about. It's just whenever I get definite, that's what we'll refer to. All right, so let's suppose we start solving it with the same problems on x is equal to plus or minus 1, the same boundary condition, u is naught on x is plus and minus 1. Going to do something numerically as it looks like, so you divide minus 1 to 1 up into m elements. All right, now, we do this here by introducing internal boundary conditions that will break this interval up into isolated elements, and then we'll stick them back together again. And that's the trick. All right, so at the center of each element, we'll have a grid point. So 1 through to m are internal grid points. X naught and x m plus 1 are the boundaries. X is equal to minus 1 and 1. Now, if we just insulated these elements, what then happens? So here's insulating boundary conditions on put at the interior of each element. What happens? Diffusion in each element causes exponential decay to a constant inside each element. It's a different constant for each element, and it pops out of it because you've got that zero eigenvalue of the dynamics with insulated boundary condition, and it arises because everything else is diffusive, dissipative. All right, so we use center manifold theory again to perturb this picture back to the original. Right, we want to put these elements, sort of glue them back together again, get them talking to each other so that we can recover a solution to the original problem. And a good way to do this is, looks really weird, it's this way. I thought this was the single best way to do it, but then I realised I still have a... It may not be, there are still things I might need to twiddle with this. But let's just have a look at the left-hand boundary condition, which is this first one here. Use VJ to denote the field in the jth element that we're trying to find. So what this condition says is VJ, the field in the jth element at the jth grid point, when you compare it to what the jth field predicts at the jth minus 1 grid point, so that's the grid point on the left, that's gamma into the difference of the values u at those grid points. Why should we want to do that? When gamma is naught, these are effectively insulation conditions. Right? When gamma is naught, the right-hand side isn't there. This just says the field at xj and at xj minus 1 is the same. And if you look at what constraints that puts on the spectrum, it's effectively an insulation boundary condition. And discretely, that left-hand side is sort of like d/dx. Now, when gamma is 1, what happens? When gamma is 1, that uj is actually the same as the jth field evaluated at the jth grid point. And so those two things cancel. And so all that you're left with is a statement that you evaluate the field in the jth element's field at the grid point to the left, and you've got to be hit exactly the grid value there. Right, so that recovers the fact that sort of glues all these elements together. and it looks weird, but it works. Given that we've cut up the domain like this, we can apply the center manifold theory. It says it exists. There's an m-dimensional model parameterized by those m grid values, uj. And you can see how this is a numerical method because it's just said that there is a model of the dynamics given by just m values. And it says here we are, the original physical field u of xt is some function v of those grid values times and a function of x and the parameter gamma, such that the grid values evolve in time according to some prescription. So that's the first thing. It exists. The second thing is interesting. It says that this discrete model is exponentially quickly attractive to all nearby solutions of the PDE. Right? There is no qualification on the grid size H. So most classical methods of numerical approximation, which talk about consistency as H tends to zero, as one of the key features in deriving the model, right, this approach is completely different to that. Right? There's no small h limit. This is at finite h. So how does it work if it's at finite h? Well, it works because the third center manifold theorem tells you how to construct these models. It's simply that you substitute this ansatz into the partial differential equation and solve it. Right? So we're not appealing to consistency. We're appealing here to solutions of the partial differential equation. Now, it's true that we don't solve it exactly, but it is done asymptotically in this case, in the coupling parameter gamma. And just to show you that, this is a bit segment of the computer algebra code I used in this problem. And you can see it's an asymptotic solution because I've got a statement here which says as soon as you see a power of gamma higher than 3, set it to 0. Actually, 3 or higher. I can set that to anything I like. You can see that I solve the differential equation because I just compute the residual here. I've got a repeat loop. This computes the residual of the differential equation. And then I repeat this loop until that residual is zero. So I don't stop until I found a solution. Whatever else goes on in there, it doesn't stop until there's a solution to that error. And the same is true, there's the boundary condition sitting there. So all of those have to be satisfied. And it's really easy to do this. There are many computer algebra programs and that you may or may not have been told, and it's a lot easier to do it in this iterative framework. Most of them try to get you to get you involved in too much detail of the algebra. All right, so that bit says there is a numerical model which we construct. Let's have a look at boundary conditions now. Not the internal boundary conditions, but the physical boundary conditions. How can they be built into the model, into this process, I should say? And the answer is dead easy. If you look at the boundary condition the internal boundary conditions, say on the left side of an element, that was this one up here. If you're at the very leftmost element, right, what about this don't you know? Well, the answer is you know everything in there except the grid value u0. But of course, if you've got a boundary condition, you know what u0 is, so you just use that. So that's what I propose here. If we have got the boundary condition that u is 0 at the end, so I just put 0 for u0, and that's the boundary condition to use. And again, the same thing goes through. When gamma is 0, this element's insulated not only from all the other elements, but also the physical boundary condition. When gamma is 1, it reinforces that boundary condition. And so we're interested in this solution when, by evaluating it at gamma is 1. Right, so let's just show some results. Computer algebra again solves the differential equations not only in the interior, but you can use exactly the same code near the ends. You just get slightly different answers. And here is the description of the field in this particular problem. That's the solution in the first element, and this down here is the solution in the second element. And you can say, hey, that's what I would have written down from Lagrange interpolation. And that's exactly right. Disagrees with traditional approximations in its first step. But what it is, that first step is just the first step down a completely different road, in that when you go to the next order terms, the order gamma squared, gamma cubed, so on, you're looking at more and more complicated physical interactions that take place inside each of those elements, and the flow of information that's coming in from the surrounding elements to build up a sort of a sophisticated resolution of all that subgrid scale structure and to give you a model of the original problem. So here, with errors gamma cubed, is the evolution near the boundary. And if you look at the order gamma terms again, you'd say that's exactly what you'd get with Lagrange interpolation. Right here is u du by dx sitting in there. The gamma squared terms are where things start varying. It's almost inconceivable to think that you would have discretized the u du by dx to fourth order accuracy in this sort of form. But nonetheless, this theory says that this is a good form to use, right? Because it's coming at a completely different angle. And it's looking at what's going on inside each element. One advantage of this approach is that the model has got the same bandwidth across the whole domain. It's always irked me that if you try a high order accuracy boundary condition, it's always sort of ruined the bandwidth in most cases. But this one, this approach works wonderfully. Okay, so I'm going to have to take one of my stochastic jumps. One of the bits I did skip over just then is what happens if you've got boundary forcing, and you can incorporate that easily. And one of the things you resolve is actually the time lag it takes for a forced boundary to diffuse into the element. So this method resolves the fact that it is finite grid size. But let's move on to, this is really a transitional problem. What if we try and do the same approach to a problem that's a little bit more complicated, in that we've got two spatial dimensions. This is flow down a channel and time. So we're looking at the concentration little c, the function of space and time. It might satisfy an advection diffusion equation like this. So there's the advection with a parabolic velocity profile. Also have diffusion with a parabolic profile to mimic what might happen in a channel where the depth is varying and there's different levels of, say, turbulent mixing, but mainly because you can make algebraic progress with that profile of diffusion. Right, so what's the analog of this sort of this playing around with boundary conditions? Well, here's the channel here. What you can do is you just put in vertical barriers. That's these blue lines. So the two-dimensional domain is now broken up into a one-dimensional sequence of rectangles connected up across an internal boundary. And then we connect these by very similar internal boundary conditions that I showed you before. All right, so the jth field at the jth plus 1 grid point, it's actually at the jth plus 1 cross section, not the grid point. See, y can vary. Compared with the jth field at the jth cross section is equal to the appropriate combination in gamma. All right, so it does the same thing there. And we construct solutions in powers of that k coupling gamma. Okay, so if you look at the gamma is naught case, each rectangle is insulated from all its neighbours. You've got essentially a diffusion problem there, albeit advection as well. The solution will, in the long term, decay to zero in each rectangle. So whatever goes on in that each of those rectangles can be parameterized by one parameter, which I've got as little cj. That should really have been a big cj. The physical field, there's the algebra. Here's a drawing of it if we've got one grid point at one and all the other grid point values at zero. So this is rather an extreme case. And you can see that there is a subgrid scale structure associated with any set of grid values. That's the point here. Applying the computer algebra then tells you how those grid values interact. And this looks rather complicated. But just very briefly, what you have here is a fourth order approximation to the downstream diffusion. This is actually a term which ensures that discretization is stable if you throw away all the gamma squared terms. It's very interesting that it's there. Now this magenta term is the amazing one, because it's p was the mean downstream velocity, p for Peclet number, and it's proportional to that squared. There's also a division by this diffusion coefficient if you put that in. This term here is the shear dispersion term that can be very large in applications. The Peclet number can be as large as hundreds or thousands. So this dominates applications of this of dispersion in channels or pipes. And the reason why I'm so pleased it's here is because the only derivation of that term necessarily involves assuming very large scale evolution, solutions on a very large scale. What else we got? We got downstream advection at the mean velocity. I should have pointed that out earlier, I guess. And a few other corrections. And I won't go through that. But when evaluated gamma equals 1, that does really well. All right. The fact that we see this shear dispersion at finite grid size is, again, because we're resolving subgrid scale processes. So what's this got to do with continuum modeling? Well, let me use this shear dispersion as an example. In fact, that's why I went through it, is as a step to this section. Just imagine taking the limit of this equation as h goes to 0, the grid size. Now, up to date, I've said everything is on finite h. But what happens when you let h go to 0 is all these delta functions, all these deltas, these are centered differences and fourth order centered differences, they all tend to derivatives. So we can take an h limit of that formally, although there's a few dodgy bits in it. And what you get out of the result is essentially the Taylor model for advection and diffusion along a pipe. And I don't think I've written it down, have I? Okay, I'll show it to you later. So the Taylor model says something like dc by dt is equal to minus u dc by dx plus a diffusion term d squared c dx squared. Simple advection diffusion equation. Now comes the problem. Those sort of models arrive commonly, say in beam theory, the Ginzburg-Landau equation that you've seen a number of times, even the NLS equation, although I don't want to comment any further on that, or indeed these. The issue there is these spatiotemporal models require boundary conditions. Some problems, the boundary conditions don't seem to be an issue. some problems they are. I mean, we saw some numerical simulations here saying, well, we could only go up to time 256 because after that the boundaries started influencing what was going on in the core. I think we need to spend more time on boundary conditions in those sort of problems. So the question is what? Can we get boundary conditions in the limit of the grid size going to zero in this approach for continuum models? Well, not that I can see, which is a bit unfortunate. But there are still arguments we can provide. So what I'm going to sketch in the last quarter of an hour is how boundary conditions can be derived for spatial models such as the Taylor model for dispersion in the stream, or in principle the things like the Ginzburg-Landau equation, or even the Swift-Homburg equation isn't an exact model anyway. But those sort of large-scale models. And the boundary conditions are provided by two separate arguments, and both of them rely on investigating the spatial evolution away from the boundary. You've seen this trick in a number of talks already. Kirch-Gassner seems to be one of the earlier people to do it, but also Mielke and Uss. All right, so let's sketch that. In particular, I'll show you specific details about the shear dispersion problem and then make generic claims just to outline what the generic results. All right, so here's the shear dispersion problem again. That should have a T dependence in it. Just got missed. So the concentration's evolving in this channel. There's advection downstream. There's cross-stream mixing. What happens? If you do the algebra directly, assuming d by dx is small, you get this. Alternatively, you take the small grid size on the previous problem I showed you and you get this. So it just says that the concentration field is the local average plus some correction to account for gradients. The evolution is this, what I said earlier, that the time derivative, well, the stuff gets advected downstream, gets diffused, and you can go to higher order, either in gamma, you get higher order terms, or in higher orders in d by dx, you get the same higher order terms. So I'm going to truncate it here. So it's one step beyond a structurally stable model, but it includes a third order term because that makes it a little more like the generic case. Specific numbers are there. This model holds far away from the inlet and the outlet because it relies on a slowly varying structure in the interior. The infinite series does converge in some sense. So it converges provided the wave numbers are long enough. In fact, they don't have to be all that long actually. But again, if you try to solve this as a model, what boundary conditions do you need at the inlet and the outlet? All right, so there's two things we have to do. So the first thing is to look at this model itself, recast in terms of the spatial evolution. So for here, if we're using a third order model, we might write big U is equal to C, big V is dC by dx, big W is two derivatives of C, and then write an evolution equation like this, du by dx is V, V dx is W, etc. Now, in the model is predicated on slow solutions, right? Most of our modeling is either slow or slowly evolving oscillations. So here it's slow solutions. So d by dt over here is a small perturbation. And so to a first order, neglect it. Then just look at what's left as a linear system. It's got spatial evolution away from either end, wherever you want to look at x, of 1-0 eigenvalue corresponding to the slow evolution in the interior. It's got an eigenvalue of plus 36 or so. So there's a component in the solution of e to the 36. There's also a component of e to the minus 118. Now, if you solve a problem with any sort of boundary conditions, what's going to happen is that, you know, you just dream up something and apply it. You're going to, these components will give you rapid transients near the outlet and near the inlet. And they should not be in the model. So you've got to get, you have to get rid of those. And that's the first of the two principles. Those rapid transients must be removed. So in this particular case, there is one condition to eliminate that growing mode, which you use at the inlet. At the outlet, e to the minus 118x is a growing mode when you look back to smaller x, so you use a condition at the outlet to eliminate that. So generically, as you can see down there, the boundary conditions are that you require the model at either end to lie in the centre unstable manifold of the spatial evolution. So the boundary condition is to say there's no stable manifold solutions at either end because they are transients in the model which are unphysical. They should not be in the model. Okay, so that's a diagram. I probably shouldn't have shown you that one. So in our problem here, that gives two boundary conditions for a third order equation in space. So you know you need another boundary condition. Where does it come from? It more or less comes from what you'd expect. I mean, if we've got stuff flowing down a channel, then surely an extra boundary condition must be at the inlet saying how much stuff the concentration of stuff we're feeding into the entrance to the channel. And that's true. So let's see how it might work, the argument might work out, and then take a huge generalization step. Now, but that statement requires that we look at the physical dynamics. So that's where the rest of the boundary conditions comes from. So we have to have a look, in some sense, at the physical equation. So here's the equation for the concentration little c in the channel, or some variation of this. Again, rewrite it for the spatial evolution. Here I've used c dashed for dc by dx. Get a couple of equations describing the evolution of c into the interior of the domain from either end. And again, this whole modelling paradigm is predicated on the fact that things are happening fairly slowly, and so d by dt is approximately zero and can be treated as a perturbation. So ignore that bit. What then happens? Well, you then have a linear operator here. It's got a spectrum of one zero eigenvalue in our problem, a number of negative eigenvalues and a number of positive ones. In fact, there's an infinite number. But as we heard this morning, an infinite number is a bit tricky. All right. The zero eigenvalue corresponds to the slow evolution of the model that we're interested in. This, in fact, is just a recasting of the Taylor's model. Now, I should say that. Let's have a look at the inlet. At the inlet, there cannot be any component of the positive eigenvalue modes, as they would blow up in the interior. That seems reasonable enough, before you reach the outlet. But the physical inlet condition will typically have decaying transients in it, right? If you, for example, discharge waste into the side of the channel at x equals zero, that waste is going to take some time before it spreads out approximately uniformly across the channel, which is the state the model describes. So there is a boundary layer. That's what I'm talking about, physical boundary layer at the inlet. So what do we need as an inlet condition? We need the appropriate cross-stream average concentration that you value after those transients have died out. But really, you want to project out those transients before they've died out. You want to apply a boundary condition that x is equal to zero. So there, you can know how to do that in a linear problem. That's to use the adjoint eigenmode of lambda is naught to project the physical inlet conditions onto that lambda equals naught mode. Yeah. So that's what happens generally. Physically, you know, I should have said one more thing. There can't be any component of the positive eigenvalued modes as they'd blow up. But it's the job of the other end to get rid of those. It's the job of the outlet, not the inlet. All right, so what happens physically is that at the inlet, you know that the system has to lie on the center stable manifold. Right, so that means that you're allowing a boundary layer to exist physically. The particular boundary condition you apply is a set of states. All right, so if you, for example, apply the fact that the concentration is specified, that's true, but you've still got all the freedom in saying, well, what's the gradient dc by dx there? You haven't specified that. So there's a whole set of states corresponding to whatever it is that you've supplied. You've only nailed down some of those states in the state space of the spatial evolution. All right, so that set of states will intersect that center stable manifold of the spatial evolution away from the inlet at some set of points. Now, I've only drawn it as one point here. Then the dynamics of the system, as you move into the interior, proceeds. And what happens is there's the center manifold mode, which is the long-lasting one of your model, and everything else is going to be decaying because this is the center stable manifold. So exponentially quickly, that initial condition decays down onto the center manifold. That's just a dynamical system's statement of the fact that there's a boundary layer. All right, so what we want at the inlet is the correct projection of that point onto the center manifold. And that's why I showed you that demonstration earlier of that two-dimensional dynamical system, showing you that that's a non-trivial problem. Right? There is in principle a projection, but you may have to do that in a non-trivial way, in a way that respects non-linearities if you've got a non-linear problem. Okay, so you project it onto the center manifold model. So that's what I've said here. In fact, the physical field's got to lie in the center stable manifold. The physical boundary conditions intersect that in a set of states. You then project those set of states onto the slow manifold of the interior model along those... did I call them isochrons earlier? I can't remember if I actually told you the name. Along those coloured isochrons of that model system I showed you. What about the counting? Is there in fact an intersection? Or if there is an intersection, maybe it intersects in a whole heap of states, and so when you do the projection, there is no constraint. That last case is precisely what happens at the outlet, in fact. Is at the outlet, the center stable manifold is one dimension smaller. No, sorry, one dimension bigger. Better get it right. So the set of intersections is one dimension higher. So when you project it onto so instead of being a point, it actually turns out to be some sort of curve. When you project it onto the center manifold of the spatial evolution, you get that the fact that any state is allowed, which means there's no boundary condition at the outlet. And there's all, and you can think about all those statements physically if you've ever got a particular problem you're interested in. Ah, so I've already said all that. So, this then is my conclusion. What I've talked about is two different scenarios, playing around with boundary conditions, that you can derive numerical models by cutting space up into chunks and then gluing it back together again and resolving the subgrid scale fields. But also that leads into, although I did this historically about 15 years earlier, the fact that when you're deriving continuum models, partial differential equation models for dynamics, you might need a completely different mechanism for resolving the influence of the transients, as they were, that occur near spatial boundaries, which we know as boundary layers. And the moreover is more or less to say that dynamical systems, state-space arguments, is an excellent way to try and resolve all these issues. I won't go through there. I should also point out there is also a third approach to boundary conditions that I've got, and it's unclear to me whether these approaches all really produce equivalent boundary conditions. That's research that needs to be done still. So thanks.